We're following a thread. We're following the theme of what the 20th century, 21st century even, Bodhisattva looks like. So the Bodhisattva, the being sort of bent on enlightenment, the being of awakening, being of practice, the Bodhisattva. So this evening I'm going to be looking at or following that theme through. My title was something like Ethical Challenges for the Modern World. And there are many, many, many ethical challenges in the modern world. So I've chosen to focus perhaps on just one of those training principles, those ethical precepts that we've already chanted this evening. So I'm going to focus down on the mind precepts, or some of the mind precepts. So these precepts or guidelines in how we live our ethical lives. So I want to focus on the mind precept from both the five precepts and the 10 precepts, the precepts that order members take. So with mindfulness clear and radiant, I purify my mind. And the negative precept, abstaining from intoxicants that cloud the mind. So we're going to be looking at a very particular form of intoxicants and intoxication, something that intoxicates the mind, that clouds the mind, clouds us from seeing clearly. And then the precept from the 10 precepts, the 10 precepts that order members take, transforming ignorance into wisdom. I purify my mind. Or I undertake to abstain from false views. False views are what naturally arise. They're naturally sort of how we see the world, how we interpret our experience. The transformation, the process of transformation from ignorance, from false view, wrong view, comes through, to some extent, just naturally through our practice. We learn to see more clearly. So I'm going to be looking at both how those two sort of precepts relate. It's a little bit far away. Dangerous. I can see properly.
Yeah, the light.
And I'm fine for the light, it's just the distance. Thank you. Yeah. So I've been very inspired in recent months by a couple of books, and they're actually books by a neuroscientist and a historian. Which might seem a little bit strange, giving a Dharma talk, Buddhist talk. But this, the one by the neuroscientist, is called Mind Change. So it's relevant. And the one by the historian, Yuval Noah Harari, is called 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. So I thought this actually fitted in, the title fits in really nicely with the title of our theme, the 21st Century Bodhisattva. So both are connected with how modern technology is coming to affect our lives and our minds. So both have quite a recent perspective, if you like. But the why it can be really useful to look at the perspective of a historian. I think historians have something very, very sort of valuable to bring. in the sense of perspective over time. So we can see how things, a historian can see what's changed over time, and whether that change has, where things have changed for the better, and where things are changing in less sort of helpful ways. Usually it's a bit of both. So I was thinking, I remember Sangharakshita talking about this in relation to a survey of Buddhism, in a way his him putting the this perspective of time, or putting Buddhism in a historical perspective. And I remember him saying that most other Buddhist times haven't had that perspective. They've just been right in their own perspective. They haven't had, if you like, the I was going to say luxury, but it's not a luxury. But it changes and opens up how you see things. You see trends and patterns. You see connections and how something has come about. You see the conditions that have brought something into being, and then how those conditions then bring something else into being. So one of the things that Yuval Noah Harari talks about, and I think I'm going to have a hard time if I have to say that name too often in the talk. I've got his initials written down on my notes most of the time. Yuval Noah Harari, he's Israeli. So one of the things that he's writing about is, in a way, how we've moved from being a world full of nations, a world of countries, if you like. Our borders have been through our own, the country that I live in. And now he's saying we live in a much, much more global world. Globalization has affected the world that we live in massively. Increasingly, we are thinking in terms of global concerns. And we can't really separate what affects us from what affects the country on the other side of the world. You know, the financial markets, international trade, international communications, international travel, the internet. Actually, the internet has broken probably more barriers than anything. In terms of, somebody could be sitting next to you when you're on a Skype call with a friend. I had a friend, I was Skype calls with her in New Zealand, and I'm now having Skype calls in Germany because she's moved back. We could be in the same room. So things have changed a lot, and they've changed very, very recently. So Yuval Noah Harari says of globalization, he says, global world puts unprecedented pressure on our personal conduct and morality. Each of us is ensnared within numerous all-encompassing spider webs, which on the one hand restrict our movements, but at the same time transmit our tiniest jiggle to faraway destinations. And he gives a couple of examples. He says, our daily routines influence the lives of people and animals, New Zealand lamb, on the other side of the world, and some personal gestures can unexpectedly set the entire world ablaze, as happened with the self-immolation of Mohammed Bonazizi in Tunisia, which ignited the Arab Spring. The other example he gives is women sharing their stories online, and the Me Too movement being born and sort of flowering incredibly quickly. So I'm going to come back to globalization, probably if I have time, right at the end of the talk. But just really to acknowledge the effect, the changes that it's wrought, and particularly through technology most recently. So I'm not denying in any way the positive effects of technology, but there are pitfalls for us, particularly as practitioners, as meditators, if we are following a path where we are looking to for our minds to become more clear, to transform wrong, unhelpful views into a wiser perspective. So it's perhaps important that we're alert to some degree of how fast the world is changing and the effects that those changes might be having. Because even though they change the world is changing very fast, the effects can sort of go unnoticed. They can become the new normal. The new normal, something becomes such that we take it for granted very, very quickly. I mean, I now carry my phone with me pretty much wherever I go. And I don't know, I was remembering when I first got a mobile phone, and it was a really, really primitive little thing that pretty much did nothing but make calls. I'm not even sure I used it for texting. And that was probably, well, it was less than 20 years ago. And it was so expensive to use. Mostly I had it when I was working in Spain and I could hardly bear to use it because it was so expensive. So the broader question is, how do we look after our minds and develop our minds within the changing world. So I want to look a little bit at the, if you like, the danger, the dangers of a sort of losing our minds in a particular sort of way, the downsides of, and then perhaps a loss of autonomy. So I just want to highlight a few things, and there's lots I could say. I mean, I did really enjoy both these books, and there's a lot that can be drawn out. Actually, this one is going to be in the library afterwards, so you'll be able to borrow that. If you get interested in what you hear, you can borrow it.
Can't see which one that is.
That's the 21 Lessons for the 21st Century.
Okay.
So these things are some of them are drawn from my own experience. So I put my hand up to a reliance, an increasing reliance on Google. I probably only said "Hello, Google" for the first time about a year ago. I would just laugh when Vajrapriya would talk to his phone at the dinner table, mm-hmm. And now I do it all the time. So I think it's really important to. Maybe this is obvious, but the information, having information is not the same as having knowledge. It's not the same as understanding. Yuval Noah Harari, he says, truth is defined by the top results of a Google search. And I think there's quite a danger in that we come to think that we know something, even that we understand something because we've read two or three results from a little Google search. So if you like, we're losing the sense of our own research, our own pondering, our own reflection, the easier it is to just reach for, to look things up. I think it's also worth acknowledging that at the click of a few buttons is a mine of completely useless information, or if not completely useless, largely useless information that we are, if you like, stuffing into our heads. Well, I speak for myself. Maybe you don't all stuff into your heads, and I appreciate that it's not everybody does that. Um, But what we're looking to do in practice is to use our minds in a different way, in a way where we do actively reflect, we do actively, in a way, use what's already there, use our own experience to, with selective input from external sources. So I think there's a whole world through technology of if you like de-skilling and dumbing down, which I have been aware of. You know, I've been aware for myself in using a sat nav. In a way, it fosters a dependency. That will I know how to get myself somewhere on my own if I don't have it, or if I don't have Google Maps telling me what to do? Yes, spelling, predictive text is another. It's a really small thing. What happens when I allow predictive text to finish my sentences for me, just because it's a little bit easier, and maybe it's not quite what I was going to say? Do we all end up speaking the same, or just slightly differently because Google thinks that I use these words more than, say, somebody else does? There's just a little something I feel is lost, but it's very hard not to do. Resist it for a little while, and then it's like, okay. I just thought, great, that sounds good, because then it just takes one click rather than about 15. So in a way, I'm allowing technology to sort of modify something. I'm allowing something from the outside to modify, which happens in many, many different ways, but it's worth being conscious about what are the influences that are modifying us. And in a way, what are they learning about us through that, some degree of passivity, or taking the easy path, taking the path of least resistance? So it's an increasing amount of... technology is designed towards making up our minds, making an increasingly sophisticated ways making up our minds about what we like. They also so that's in the world of advertising and selling, but also things like these days, when you go to get a bank loan, for example. My dad was a bank manager a long time ago. Fairly friendly bank manager, though. I think he had his moments. But these days, what you've got is much more likely to be technology for some sort of algorithm to be making that decision, basing it on various bits of information sort of gathered about you. There was something that happened when we were buying the house just along the road a couple of years ago, and trying to find some insurance, some house insurance. And I knew it might be a little bit difficult because we live so close to the river, but I actually looked up the government tables, and the government considers us a low flood risk in our house up the road. But the insurance companies were quite sort of... there were very few that would actually give us any insurance. And I eventually phoned someone up. I was looking online. I phoned this guy up. And he said, we don't know why. We don't know what it is. It might just be your postcode. They sort of... But it basically, it's not being decided by human beings. It's a load of sort of facts and figures being stuck into a computer and... spitting out things, and people don't know why. Not only The customer doesn't know why, but the person, the bank manager or the insurance broker, doesn't know why either. So increasingly, things are sort of becoming a bit independent of the people who are deciding it. So it's taken me a little time to get my head around what an algorithm is. See if you can make anything of this. It's an unambiguous specification of how to solve a class of problems. Algorithms can perform calculations, data processing, and automated reasoning tasks, like insurance, like bank accounts. But what they can also do, which I thought this was, I don't quite know what I think about this, but I came across a little advert on Facebook for a phone company, and I can't pronounce them. It's Huawei or something. Huawei. Okay. And what they're advertising is, you may know or you may not know that Schubert wrote an unfinished symphony. It's called, it's the eighth symphony, and it's called Schubert's Unfinished Symphony. And this has been finished off. I think two movements out of, I think about, so about half of it has been finished off by a computer algorithm in conjunction with a composer. It's quite extraordinary, and I don't really know what I think about it. But what this algorithm has done is it's found, it's looked at the patterns of the pre-existing music. The style, it's analysed the key musical elements, and it's generated the melody of that missing. It sort of interpreted what would be likely to come next, and it's analysed all this data and popped up with this. What next? Computer-generated poems. say to the poet in the room. Yes. They're very complex. But they're also quite used to some quite how to describe it? Unpleasant purposes. There's a lot of algorithms that are not good for the world. But there was an article in The Guardian a few days ago about something called a psychographic algorithm. And what this was doing was, it was an algorithm that would work out which particular segment of the population to target with a particular sort of message. There's more detail to it, but I won't go into that. But the aim was not to change someone's mind from one political perspective to another perspective, but the aim was to disillusion them in their own perspective and get them to abstain. So the idea behind that piece of software is to generate negative mental states, to generate sort of a passivity, a cynicism, disillusionment. So there's a lot that, as I say, things that it's about the inputs going into our minds. If we're not so aware of it, it will have consequences. So that's a bit about the dangers and the downsides. I just want to focus a little bit on one sort of particular bit of tech, and that's because it's the one that most of us have, and that is the mobile phone. And I think how we use our phones is very, very relevant to what we're doing in our meditation practice, our mindfulness practice. So I think phones are for a lot of people, maybe you have to have a slightly addictive personality in the first place, but I think they're quite addictive. And in here, Susan Greenfield, the neuroscientist, goes quite a lot into the brain chemicals that are released. Anticipation is quite a big one. And actually that's often what gets generated through mobile phones. We maybe hear that little ding-a-ling, whatever it is, text coming in or something. There's often a little hit of dopamine, a chemical called dopamine. That's the anticipation chemical. If you like, it's a bit of an intoxicant in its own right. So this sort of links us back to the precept. It's whew. So we're not ingesting anything. We're not even having a cup of coffee and getting a bit of a high from that. But simply by developing this sort of, or allowing this sort of relationship with our phone to develop, we're more and more likely to respond to that little moment, that little hit. One of the things she says, which I've found quite helpful to remember or to look at in my experience, is that the hit of anticipation is as good as it gets. Usually what follows is a bit of a letdown. And I notice this quite often now. So there'll be a little sound because I haven't put my phone on silent. So a little sound message. So I can feel, I can be, if I'm aware enough, I can feel that little rise of energy, that little hit. And then I look and it's GifGaff telling me they've given me a phone top up. Which is costing me another £10 or something. So really nothing to get excited about. And I can feel it's like, a little bit of deflation. So I'm tracking those sorts of inflations, intoxications and deflations. So one little statistic on phone use is that 79% of us check our phone within 15 minutes of waking up. So are we a statistical representation here? So who will admit to checking their phone at least sometimes within 15 minutes of waking up?
Ooh,
look at us. Okay, but not some. Well done. So that's the pull, isn't it? The pull of compulsivity, the pull of sort of the addicted mind. And it can feel a bit harmless, but actually I know my own experience, if I do nothing, it just gets, it gets more frequent. The relationship becomes more compulsive.
Do you mean if nothing comes through for a while?
No, I mean if I don't do anything about it, if I sort of just let it continue to happen. Yeah, which I don't. Periodically I make resolves to do various things, you know, not to look at it until after breakfast or something, and then I break them. So one way I think that checking, that in a way not allowing ourselves to be unconnected from our tech, I think it affects our ability to be alone. And when we're not connected, when we're just with ourselves, then we rely a bit more on our inner resources. We're not looking, there's not that pull to the externals. The habit of reaching outside of ourselves for some sort of satisfaction. And even it's not consciously done, but it becomes, the link forms. If we do nothing, the link forms. We just respond each time, like one of Pavlov's dogs. We just respond, ding, check. So, and the other thing, I think, being connected in that way, or this could be more broadly about how we use technology, so phones, but also computers, iPads. We're often multitasking. We don't stay long with one thing or another. So we're driven, often we can be driven by whatever catches our attention momentarily. That's often how sites work. They work to sort of catch your attention, you follow it, and then you go somewhere else. So that, I think, has quite a direct effect on our ability to concentrate, our ability to just simply let the mind be a little bit stiller, a little bit calmer, allow it to gather itself, because it's always being dispersed through our tech. So I want to talk a little bit more, having talked a bit about losing our minds, I want to talk a bit about finding our minds. And I was quite delighted, again, the Yuval Noah Harari 21 Lessons for the 21st Century, towards the end of the book, he's saying, well, what can we do about... what can we do in a way about what's happening to our worlds and what's happening to our minds? And he talks about meditation, and actually he's been meditating for quite a long time. So I was very, very happy to read that. So with meditation, we're looking to find our minds, put it that way. We're keeping the initiative, we're staying a bit closer to home. So when we do that, it's easier to be aware of what's happening. To check the effects that something has on us. We may not always be that successful, as I describe for myself. I have these resolutions, I have some awareness, and then I lose that. So it's a question of bringing back mindfulness. So we can check the effects on how the mind is, how the mood is. I think that's really, really helpful to check in with how you're feeling after, perhaps feeling like you've just been on the computer a bit too long. And maybe for valid reasons, maybe for work reasons, but what's the effect on the mind? Being more in a virtual world than in the world of the senses. So there's obviously huge, huge potential, unlimited potential in how we can develop our minds. But there's a trend in society, whether or not we are partaking of it that directly, there's a trend in society to, be losing our minds, giving things away. So it's really important that we find these resources that nourish our minds, that in a way help us develop them, cultivate good qualities. So retreats are obviously a really good way to do this, partly because they are generally a tech-free space. We're generally in nature, we're away from our usual habits and distractions. So when I started meditating in the 80s, that was a good thing. It was a good thing getting away from all the usual things in life. But I think now the contrast is that much stronger, really, in terms of what I'm getting away from and the effects it has on my mind. So a little quote from Einstein. So Einstein, big intellect, but actually he was a great believer through his own experience in the power of the non-rational. Not the irrational, but the non-rational. He said that he thought daydreaming, of which he apparently did quite a lot, was the only pathway to new ideas in the mind. So we can take daydreaming in different ways. It's not just sort of allowing the mind to flick. We can sort of half daydream even while we're flicking through various TV channels or web pages, but to actually just allow ourselves the space to let the mind be free and let it roam, and we can just be a little bit, we can follow it to some extent where it's roaming, where it's going, to give it space. One of my one of the meditation teachers I really enjoy is someone called Andrea Feller, and she talks about how in spiritual practice we don't know where we're going. So she's talking about the benefits of receptive practice, but I think it's this falls into the category of daydreaming, sort of daydreaming stroke awareness, just allowing the mind to be open, not rushing to fill it up with something, allowing it to be a bit more in its natural state, which may be quite full, quite busy, may not feel like anything very sort of productive is happening, but just allowing the spacious, open, allowing something to emerge from that, and not necessarily knowing what. So we have to drop a sense of agenda, a sense of goal, and just stay with what's happening in our experience. So staying with that unknown, we if you like, use awareness of what's happening to go beyond the known. And this is one way of talking about wisdom, moving from the ignorance of habits, the ignorance of I can't think of another way to describe it, to this more sort of creative, open space. So I want to just briefly come back to globalization, globalism, if you like, opportunities for interconnectedness within the 21st century. So this is bringing us back to the theme that's been running through all our weeks, the 21st century Bodhisattva. So I just want to talk about three things very briefly. So one is actually a virtual experience. So using technology, or using the best of technology in ways a bit like the unfinished symphony. So this is something that Carolyn was telling me about just last week, actually, which is an exhibition in London that I'm hoping to go to see, called, has a beautiful name, it says, We Live in an Ocean of Air. And it's an exhibition that is a virtual experience of interconnectedness. It's exploring our invisible connection between plant and human worlds. And it's through the technology, it makes those invisible connections that are there all the time, it makes them visible. I'm so looking forward to seeing this. So if that can, I imagine that the effect of that could be quite strong. We hear about interconnectedness, but actually seeing on a cellular level how that is, I imagine. We'll see what happens. But it's certainly a very creative use. I don't know how successful it will be, but it's certainly a creative idea, and using technology to help realise that. The other thing I wanted with, I suppose maybe it's with, we know so much about what's happening in the world through our international communications. You know, we hear about natural disasters within minutes of them occurring. It's almost real time, our news. And in there is an opportunity to empathise, to respond creatively, to respond not on the basis of something that's affecting me or my sort of small world or even my country, something that's affecting, it affects me because I'm part of this global community. Sometimes we hear the news is very mixed, isn't it? We hear a lot of things that we perhaps can empathise with, but we also hear about things that repel us. That it's hard not to be disgusted by some of the things that happen in our world. And I was remembering this very well-known poem by Thich Nhat Hanh, "Please Call Me By My True Names." And there's a bit in here, I mean, there's a lot, and maybe I'll leave it out so you can have a look, because I'm running out of time. But I'm just going to read a couple of the verses. I am the mayfly metamorphosing on the surface of the river, and I am the bird which, when spring comes, arrives in time to eat the mayfly. I am the child in Uganda, all stint skin and bones, my legs as thin as bamboo sticks, and I am the arms merchant selling deadly weapons to Uganda. I am the 12-year-old girl, refugee on a small boat, who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate. And I am the pirate, my heart not yet capable of seeing and loving. I think that the massive range of things in the world gives us an opportunity to practice that perspective, to open to that perspective. Of those whose hearts are not yet capable of seeing and loving. Because I think we could probably also identify with moments when our own hearts are not yet capable of seeing and loving. So then the final thing is Sangha, what an opportunity we have in Sangha to... we have ways that we really meaningfully come together. Actually, last year we had lots of ways that we... I was thinking actually of the fundraising. We came together in perhaps ways that we... hadn't for a little while, because But coming together as a Sangha through building the center, coming together through running events, coming together through practice, on the basis of our shared values, our shared ethics, this really helps affirm those ethics, with each other. Helps affirm the positive values. So I want to end just with Yuval Noah Harari. Has this sentence. He says, "For every dollar we invest in AI, in artificial intelligence," and it's massive, absolutely massive, the amount of dollars being invested, pounds being invested. "For every dollar we invest in AI, we should invest the same amount of time and money in advancing human consciousness." Now, wouldn't that be something? Wouldn't that be pretty amazing? It's probably not going to happen, but in a way, it's what we're doing. It's what we're doing with our lives, our time, our energy, our enthusiasm, our connectedness with each other. And there's going to always be more that we can do. To develop our consciousness, to develop the capacity of our mind, to love, capacity of the mind, to wisdom. So I don't think it matters that it would be nice if there was a dollar for dollar, but actually it's really down to us to just keep the initiative in our own practice and keep sharing our own, in a way, re-inspiring each other with our own Dharma practice.